Coming up today on Davisville, one of the musicians who created this iconic song. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRT-LP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. We live at KDRT.org online. I'm Bill Buchanan. Thank you for tuning in today. My guest today is Chris Hillman. When he was in his early 20s in the mid-1960s, he co-founded The Byrds, one of America's biggest bands of the decade and still influential more than half a century later. Well, that's true of the band and also of him. The bass line you heard at the start of 8 Miles High, the beginning of today's show, is his. Chris has been a member of a half dozen groups, all influential or successful to varying degrees, including the Flying Burrito Brothers, Desert Rose Band, Manassas, and he has released several solo records over his long career. His latest is Biding My Time, produced by Tom Petty shortly before Tom Petty died. Chris's music ranges from rock to country to bluegrass. Still performing, and 76 years old this December, Chris has written a book, Time Between, about his experiences along the way. We'll talk with him in a minute, but first we'll hear a little more of his music. This is him with the Byrds singing the first song he wrote, also called Time Between.
Don't say you love me, don't say you care, you're so far away. Telephone communication, only a 3-minute elation when I hear your voice. Through love and trust, it's gonna work out fine. The only pain I feel is all this time between you and me. You and me.
Chris, thanks for joining us today. You know, the first question I have is, what do you want people to take from your book, Time Between?
Bill, I want people to take a sense of never surrender. It's a noble sentiment, but never surrender. I think that a lot of the book is saying what I wrote was, despite having a horrible situation in our family with my dad dying, and then I had a serious disease, and just things happened to me that I would keep getting up off the ground, so to speak, and moving forward. And I really say that to everyone, that you really don't just give up. And I think mostly I'm going to emphasize that, because I see the stats. Of course, I don't believe half what the media says anymore, but I see statistics about suicides around COVID and this hopelessness, especially the small businessman. And he's told, especially where we're in this state of California, Bill, and we're getting told one thing one day and one another. In Ventura County, they're going to close, they're going to open. So the guy that has the small business is struggling. And besides the COVID and the fear that has been generated around the country, I'm just saying to everybody, don't give in. Stay strong and don't surrender.
So your story then, of course, is told through your life. Your persistence is what's in the book.
Yes, I'm sorry. It is in the book. And that's the subtext. I'm talking about redemption. I'm talking about mentors. I'm talking about pick yourself up off the ground.
Let's talk for a minute about the song Time Between, because not only is it the title of your book, but it's the first song you wrote for the Byrds, correct?
Correct, yes.
And you write in the book that you had been kind of shy and you were playing bass in the back of the band. Mm-hmm. And then one of the members, Gene Clark, left. So that kind of created a move to move you forward. But suddenly you started writing and singing songs. And as I was thinking about this, this is an example of the apprenticeship, right? You had learned a lot of things.
I was an apprentice.
And the band, I mean, obviously they needed to promote you to the front to kind of replace Gene a little bit, but Gene, and I'm talking David Crosby here and Roger McGuinn, they also clearly saw you had some ability.
I could sing then, Bill, back in 65, but I couldn't, I mean, I could sing in tune, but I didn't have the wherewithal. I wasn't a good singer yet. where I was really selling that song. And it's an acting job, but I had great teachers. So here's McGuinn and Gene and David were wonderful singers. So I'm sitting back and okay, and I would sing a couple of gigs we used to do. I was always have a song or two that I would sing in the show. And it, you know, I would just listen and it was mostly an issue with confidence. So after the Birds, I get into the Flying Burrito Brothers with Graham Parsons and I'm singing more. But I really started to get a hold of who I was and how I could sing over the through the 70s and learned how to do it and had the confidence until late 80s in the Desert Rose Band. I was running the band and singing the lead and all that. So I always look at that. My apprenticeship was really over when the Desert Rose Band started and it took off.
You were a member of a lot of different bands, about a half dozen, depending on how you want to count them. And that's kind of unusual for musicians of your era. It wasn't unusual for someone to sort of make it big in a band and then they go solo, or maybe they join one other band. Yeah. But you were in several. I mean, and this isn't even counting the Scottsville Squirrel Barkers, if I've got mm-hmm. that name right. But the Birds and the Flying Burrito Brothers and Southern Hillman yeah. Furay and yeah. Desert Rose Band and et cetera. That told me a couple things. First, you've got a long career. Second, you like being in a group. And third, a lot of people like playing with you. Is that all right?
I hope they did. Well, I was a musician. And I saw a review of the book, Bill, and it compared the only other musician they said that had been in so many bands was Eric Clapton. I said, really? But he was in John Mayall's band, I believe. He was in the Yardbirds and Cream and a bunch of stuff. I mean, he was a musician. Of course, once again, in his world too, he became a singer. He learned how to sing. I think Delaney Bramlett taught him a lot about singing. And when Eric was working for Bonnie and Delaney, here's my explanation. I wasn't chasing down to be the next Bruce Springsteen. I wasn't good enough at that particular moment in time, but I didn't want to do that. I was a musician. I was an ensemble player. And I think my job was to keep those volatile people I worked with at distance, that keep them calm and working forward.
Well, and in fact, I think you're known as someone who holds things together, who shows up for work and, you know, does the labor yeah. required. There's a story in your book, if you could elaborate on it a bit. It's a story about the time Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones gave Graham Parsons, who you played with in the Birds and then started the Flying Burrito Brothers, gave him a lesson in social and professional responsibility. And this yeah. is because Graham, you were trying to find him because you had a concert coming up that evening, right?
And we had a show booked in El Monte, California. And I'm going, okay, we need to drive. And it's like an hour and a half drive out from Los Angeles. I couldn't find Graham. And this had been going on where he was late or he was incapacitated. And I finally find out he's at a Rolling Stones session. They were doing some recording in LA. And I go down there and I said, come on, we have to go. We're going to, we have a gig tonight. What are you doing? And Jagger walks up and he says, hey, Graham, you have a responsibility to your fans. I love this. He says, it was something like that. He says, you have a responsibility to your fans. And Chris is out in the booth there waiting for you. And we're working. And what he was trying to say is, hey, we're working here. What are you doing? What are you doing hanging around here? You have a responsibility and you got to admire him, because it is. The priority is the man or woman, the people paying money for a ticket. Your responsibility is to get up there and perform and do a great job for them. Not to politicize, not to tell them who to vote for, this or that, but to get up and perform and entertain them. They paid money to see you. So I think Jagger, he is a very professional man. He's a good businessman, obviously. Look at him. He's the only one kept a band together all these years. But that's really was a lesson for Parsons. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, that's a strength of yours too, I think, isn't it? I mean, you understand the business side of this.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Graham, it didn't take with Graham, and he continued to goof up and make mistakes. And we lost him very young. He did have some talent. He did, but he just didn't have a work ethic. He didn't have the responsibility required anyway.
One of the other stories I enjoyed from your book, this is before the Birds, that you ended up in the Green Grass Group.
Yeah.
Well, it was a concoction, right, by the former owner of the New Christy Minstrels. And you showed up, you played the work, you got good money at the time for what it was.
Horrible music, absolutely dreadful.
Yeah, and you mentioned a song about a mule.
Yeah, that, it was a bluegrass group, and it was on a level of the Beverly Hillbillies. Okay, so you can look at the Beverly Hillbillies with all due respect to them and all that, the actors and all that, but they're doing a portrayal of the hillbilly family from that weren't very bright.
Yeah.
So the Greengrass group was like a parody of bluegrass and country music, and it was just dreadful. Billy's mule can tote a wagon, he can pull a plow. Gee whiz, you know, I grit my teeth, but I got $100 a week. It was 1964, and I had a place to stay. Because I had the Golden State Boys, a.k.a. the Hillmen, had finally disbanded because the guys in the Golden State Boys, Vern and Rex Gosden, Don Parmley, they all had 10 years on me, and they all had families, and they had to go get regular jobs. They couldn't make it, so the band broke up. And I got a job with the Greengrass group until I got the wonderful phone call asking me if I could play the bass, right? Because I had gone down, and in the book you'll see this, where I had gone down and heard Gene Clark and David Crosby and Roger McGuinn singing with one guitar, and it was fantastic. So I get the call a couple of weeks later, and they said, "Can you play the bass?" And it took me 2 seconds. I knew they were going to do something. I said, "Oh yeah." I couldn't play the bass. I hadn't even held one.
No, you learned on guitar and mandolin, right?
Correct. And then I walk into the first rehearsal. I didn't even know these guys, and it was fun. I assumed they were already seasoned rock guys and all that, and I was really going, "Please, Lord, get me through this." But they weren't. They were folk guy. They came out of folk music as I did. I came out of bluegrass. They came out of folk music. But it was a good gamble on my part. So, but I did ask, I got to tell you one thing. I did ask Roger McGuinn about 2 months ago. And I say, "Hey, Roger, how many guys did you call for that bass job?" 29. He said, "No, you were the only one. We knew you were the right guy. We just called you up to see if you were interested." And
now, how did they know you were the right guy?
Well, they knew that I had a good reputation as a musician, and I was a pretty straight ahead guy that, you know, did his job, I guess, you know.
Yeah, although you bluffed him on the bass, but
yeah, I did. I bluffed him well, but we all learned together, I'll put it that way. We really developed a sound in the Birds that it wasn't a blueprint we were going off of. We created a sound that no one else had done. Yeah.
I mean, honestly, that's pretty, what's pretty compelling about it. And when you look at how the band evolved over the first few records, and really over the first six, you know, we'll get into Sweetheart of the Rodeo in a minute, but you know, going from Mr. Tambourine Man, that's the song everybody, if they've heard anything from the Birds, they've heard that, or Turn, Turn, Turn.
Turn, Turn, Turn.
But then 8 Miles High, already very, very different. And then suddenly, and we talked about this earlier, Younger Than Yesterday, the fourth record, you're suddenly writing all these songs and you're singing. Mm-hmm. Then you guys go very experimental with Notorious Bird Brothers.
Correct.
And the band is falling apart. It's basically you and Roger completing it with all these other folks. It's really a lot of change in a very short time. And that's part of what was compelling, I think, about music back then, is you could see people experimenting with it, including the Birds, taking something that was a certain thing. I mean, here you have a bluegrass background, and Roger's got folk out of Chicago, and David Crosby kind of jazz, and Gene Clark from Missouri. And,
you know it. You know the story.
But then suddenly you're doing all these interesting things. And then, of course, the thing just, boom, blows apart. I mean, in the sense of all of you went different ways eventually, except well, Roger, he stayed with the Birds. But
first of all, the industry back then allowed you to have liberties, and you get a record deal. They weren't necessarily going to abandon you if you didn't have a platinum selling record the first time out. You know, they'd stick with you for a couple records and see how to develop the act. And of course, being allowed to write your own music and this and that. Notorious is an interesting album. Notorious Bird Brothers, all of a sudden, it's McGuinn and I are finishing that record with Jim Gordon, who was the drummer for Eric Clapton, Derek and the Dominoes, and Joe Cocker, unbelievably good drummer, who ended up with a very serious, bad, bad situation in his life. But we had good players, and we finished the album. It's one of the most revered Birds record ever. I couldn't figure that. So from there, we went and did this, The Sweetheart. But at that point, it was just Roger and I, yeah. And Gary Usher, our producer, very good producer. Yeah.
I want to ask, you know, you read these sorts of things. You grow up from the outside hearing the music. Was it fun? Was it fun to do all this? I was a business, too, of course.
No, it was fun. But it wasn't fun when a member or two were not on board and we're off doing other things or not completely committed. and focused on what they were doing, because it wasn't it was unfair to the other people. This happened with Graham a lot, with David Crosby, and I love David. I talk to him all the time. But I mean, there were times in the early days when it was tough, you know. And at that particular moment in time, he wasn't showing up, and he decided he wanted to do something else. He wasn't happy in the Birds.
So yeah, Ewan McGuinn fired him, right?
Yep. That sounded very brutal. Yeah,
it does. But
first we drove up and slapped him around a little bit, and then we fired him. No, we just said it's not working, David. And I think you can. I don't know if you anybody out there or you have seen David's documentary, but it explains his in animation. I believe they did an animated thing of us firing David Crosby. And you got to. And the other thing that's wonderful about the Birds. Let's take the Birds as the well, the foundation, and all the things that came out of the Birds. Right? Crosby. Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Gene Clark went on to do solo records all through his life. And Mike Clark went into the Flying Burrito Brothers. He went into group Firefall, was very successful with that, and worked until he lost his life too. Roger, of course, continued working and mostly stayed in folk music, which is he's very happy doing. So we all did something else and successfully, very successfully.
You know, there's a quote from Marty Stewart, a very accomplished musician, but I think it says a lot about the breadth of your career, that you're the only guy in the world that can properly play 8 miles high on the mandolin.
That's Marty. Marty's one of the best mandolin players out there. I mean, I kid you not, and I've been struggling with the mandolin for 60 years. He has got it. He means that in a funny way, but he's a dear friend.
And I saw the tour, the Sweetheart. I should set this up. So Sweetheart of the Rodeo, that was the record. It was just you and Roger, and that's where Graham Parsons joined. And mm-hmm. then your cousin, mm-hmm. Kevin Kelly, was the drummer. Mm-hmm. You do this record that kind of goes off into country, Sweetheart of the Rodeo, 1968. And then 50 years later, you and Roger, the two still alive from that band, tour with Marty Stewart. You do a bunch of shows. I saw the one you did in Saratoga down in South Bay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I thought you guys did pretty well, I got to say. And that was
buddy, we
camp.
Did great. We sold out from the first night went on sale in Los Angeles. It sold out. We added another night. It sold out. Wherever we played on that tour across the country, we did unbelievable business. Now, go figure. Sweetheart of the Rodeo was not the biggest selling Birds album when it came out. We were not crossing over. We weren't going, oh, let's be a country act now. We were just the Birds making a country record. And that was the end of it. We were going to go back and stay as the Birds and do what we were doing, which was, as you said, somewhat experimental and this and that. But we were always sort of stayed within the parameters of our background, mm-hmm. folk and bluegrass and all that.
So I think you say in the book that it isn't your favorite Birds record. Mm-hmm. What I'm wondering is, you know, 50 years later, here you are playing it, remembering it and all that. I imagine that must have been kind of satisfying.
Well, we were doing it better. Let me put it this way. And especially on my end of it, the songs I sang on Sweetheart, and that was the one Bird album Roger McGuinn and I did not write songs on. Graham came to the, brought two great songs to the situation, 100 Years From Now and Hickory Wind. We didn't write any songs on that album. I don't know why. But I think when you saw us play 50 years later, we were doing the songs better. We didn't do them differently. It was the same arrangement. We were just doing them better. We were better singers, better players at that point.
Yeah. Do you ever plan to put out a CD or DVD, or you could put out a vinyl record from that tour?
I know Marty's crew taped it every night. So I think we'll probably discuss that later on, you know, when things resolve, and we'll see if we can do that. We have everything down on tape, and it's good.
Well, you know,
it's very good.
When I was reading your book and you were talking about when you were a teenager and you were listening to records of musicians who, you know, came before, I thought, well, maybe if you guys put that out, some other musician will discover that along the way and go, who are these guys? What are they doing? You know,
I hope so.
Yeah, sort of pass on.
I probably won't be around when that happens.
You never know. You never know. I also want to say I enjoyed the story about the first record you recorded. This is one of the bands, the Scottsville Squirrel Barkers.
Mm-hmm.
And it said something about the music and also maybe about the musicianship to me anyway. This is called Bluegrass Favorites. And you recorded it, you and the band, in 8 hours. And you had to use public domain songs. So there'd be no royalties. And it was live.
Oh, no, it was was live. I can't remember. I don't know if it was 8 or 4. I think it was between 4 and 8 hours. You're right. And we cut it live straight to 2-track, as I believe. And actually, in the next day or that day, we went out and did this album cover out at Griffith Park in Los Angeles. So it was wonderful. It was like getting your car painted. You drive it in, it's done. So we go and we make this record. We do the cover photo. We each got $10 and we each got a box of records. That was it. That was the deal.
Were you supposed to make money by selling the records, or was it just...
No, no. What you did back then was it would get you work. See, I've got an album. Okay. It was like an audition tape and you're giving them the album. You'd be surprised. That label was called Crown Records and you bought those in supermarkets for 79 cents. I'll tell you who was on there. Because I look on the back of the original Crown record, I think I have one. It says Ike and Tina Turner, B.B. King, Jimmy Reed. I mean, all these interesting people were on this label, this sort of inexpensive label. And they all probably had the same thing of all public domain material and put it down, no royalties, blah, blah, blah. Now, the record has been re-released in a company in England called Ace Records. And I have their CDs, and I don't know how they managed to do that. We actually recorded that, or they put that out on second-rate vinyl. I don't know how many plays one would get out of the original vinyl, because it was second-rate vinyl. So, but yeah, it worked, and it was a good record. I mean, it might have been one of the best bands I've ever been in.
Well, it struck me in the book, and I didn't mark the exact language, but you said, yeah, it's still one of your favorite records, and I thought, well... Yeah. That says great something band. About the music and ability.
Those guys were great. And as my friend Bernie Ledden said once, he said, when we were younger, we played without fear. And that's exactly right. You had a passion, you played, you learned, you went for it. And like I said earlier, nobody thought they'd get paid. You know, that was an extra treat if you got paid.
So. I got to ask you a little bit about the Flying Burrito Brothers, because this was, as it's called, a fusion of country rock and psychedelia. And your first album with them, The Gilded Palace of Sin, you know, it didn't sell all that well, but critics like the record. Rolling Stone magazine puts it in their top 500 albums. And in the book, you wrote something I'd ask you just to elaborate on a little bit. You write the players, the band name, because it's an odd name, obviously, and the songs we were writing were the perfect ingredients for something either truly grand or totally insane. And you talk about drifting back and forth between the two. If you could just elaborate a little bit on that. What made it grand? What made it insane?
The songs we wrote really held up. Okay. And I'll tell you why they held up. And because other people recorded them. Sin City, Emmylou Harris recorded, Dwight Yoakam, Katie Lang, Beck. And most of the songs on that first album, a lot of people covered, which was really complimentary. That's your ultimate seal of approval as a songwriter when someone else records your song. I felt we'd never executed it properly in the studio. Here I am coming from playing So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star with the Birds, which was a killer track, and 8 Miles High. Both great tracks. And then we do the Burrito Brothers, and the songs were good, but we were lazy. I don't know why. I should have been on top of that in hindsight. I should have been really pulling the reins in on that one. But we were lazy in the execution. And I love Graham, but he wasn't what everybody thinks he was. He was a sweet guy. He was very intelligent. He was fun to write songs with. But about after a year and a half, I lost him.
Yeah.
And how do you compete with, we have in the Mick Jagger in the studio, we have a job to do. Or do you want to go out and have fun? Are you going to go out and buy things to have fun and feel fun?
Yeah, well, that's one of the points you make in the book is that, you know, Graham had money coming in. And so maybe he wasn't.
That was it. And everybody that gets involved in a career or aspirations of being a singer or a songwriter, a dancer, an actor, a writer, you starve, you struggle until you can get hold of something that works. Do you have something successful? And having $55,000 come in every January is a detriment. It really held Graham back. That's what was his downfall. It wasn't anything else but that trust fund. And a good friend of mine who is very, very well-known country star said it. He said to me once, he said, well, you can't be a country star and have a trust fund. That was one of the funniest lines. I said, no, you can't. Because that's a strong element of the struggle to get there, to be successful. It weighs in on what you're creating, all the struggles you're going through. You're going to write and put that down in your music as to what you've been struggling with to get there. You follow? You know what I'm saying?
I do. Here's a question you might not have been asked before, but that's because it's very local. I recall you seeing you perform a benefit concert in Davis. I want to say it was in the fall of 1982, maybe for like a state park bond or something like that, something on the ballot. I think that's what mm-hmm. it was. It was some mm-hmm. kind of a fundraiser. I want to say Al Perkins was there with you, who yeah. you played with, and maybe even Bernie Ledden.
Yeah.
Does that ring a bell?
I don't remember the show, but I do remember playing in Davis, and Al and Bernie were with me. I had an acoustic quartet. Either Jerry Sheff was playing bass or Bill Bryson.
Wow.
So that was my acoustic quartet before Desert Rose Band really started to come together. That particular quartet, we went out. Actually, it wasn't Al wasn't with it. It was Herb Peterson, Bill Bryson, John Jorgensen, and myself opened shows for Dan Fogelberg, and he had us hired us to go out and play on his tour because he had done a bluegrass album.
Okay.
And upon coming back from that tour, John was really pushing to get a band going, and I sort of said, whatever.
What became the Desert Rose Band.
Yeah, and I wasn't at all interested, but all of a sudden, we had a huge fan following in LA. We had a record deal. I was really not looking for that at all. And it came our way and then put a single out. And I went into the top 20 Billboard. And then the second single, which I had written, went to number 3. It was a huge hit. And then we were off. And 8 years we were in that band. Very successful.
Your latest record is Biding My Time. That's the one produced by Tom Petty. And that was a few years mm-hmm. ago. You know, David Crosby and Roger McGuinn, the other birds still alive, are on that record on different songs.
Correct.
I know Roger has stated many times he's not interested in revisiting the birds. So I imagine your record is likely to be the closest thing to a birds recording or playing together again we're likely to get.
Maybe. I mean, if anybody could have gotten us in the studio, it would have been Tom.
Yeah.
You know, Tom was very, very close friends with Roger. They had been on the road together. They'd written songs together. And of course, David knew him and I knew him. I didn't know Tom that well. I knew him, but after working with him for 6 weeks in early 2017, I loved him. He's a wonderful guy.
Well, if that is your final record, I think it's a strong finish. You know?
Thank you. Well, I told him my last conversation with Tom is I thanked him profusely about it. I said, thank you for doing this for me. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I mean, I think this will probably be it for me as far as recording. He says, what are you talking about? I said, well, you know, I really appreciate it. He says, I'm not done with you. I said, what? He says, well, I'm not done with you. I want to make an electric album and a country album. I said, really? He says, yeah, that's what we're going to do next.
Said, well, now, are you interested? I mean, he's not here now, obviously.
No, but... no, I would only, because he said that, it was so complimentary, and I loved it. And I would have loved, he was fantastic to work with.
Yeah,
he was a man that loved all kinds of music, and the Heartbreakers were interesting because if they liked a song, if it was a Bo Diddley song, they'd cut it. You know, they just liked music, and I love that. They just took chances and did whatever they wanted. They were just consummate musicians, and Tom was like that.
Well, you do continue to play concerts, pandemic allowing.
yeah, pandemic allowing.
Usually with Herb Peterson, I think you've got some dates planned next year.
I do. I have.
I don't know if there's any up this way around Davis or Sacramento.
No, not yet. I mean, I had to move everything as everybody else did. We had to move shows and yeah. I've got some shows in Texas in February. I've got some in the spring in the Midwest and the East. We'll see what happens. You know, if they open it up, we'll see.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today. I really appreciate this.
Thank you for calling me.
Absolutely.
Nice talking to you. Very nice.
We've been talking with Chris Hillman, co-founder of The Birds, lifelong musician, about his book, Time Between, the Story of His Life. I'm Bill Buchanan. This is Davisville on KDRT LP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. Thank you for listening.